If you feel pleased with yourself for being conservation-minded and sending email invitations instead of paper cards in the mail, stay tuned. It turns out that electronic data, generating it and storing it, requires tremendous energy. Yes, data storage may be bad for the environment. I am joined by James Glanz of the New York Times, who wrote a series about how we store data and the impact data storage centers are having on our environment, and also by Dennis Szymanski, who is Senior Project Manager at the Electric Power Research Institute in Palo Alto. Thank you both for being on our show.
Pleasure.
James, we're talking about data in the context of the internet and the cloud. I think it would be great to start with some basic definitions. First of all, the cloud sounds so ephemeral, is it?
No. As someone said to me in reporting this piece, the cloud is a big concrete or steel building that you just don't happen to see because it's a long way away from you. It's filled with hard drives like the ones you use on your computer. But the cloud, the word the cloud, is a great marketing formulation that sort of takes the attention away from that physical reality.
They did it on purpose?
Oh, I don't know how it came about. I mean, somebody was probably taking a shower and came up with the idea, and it stuck. And it works in the sense that it sort of makes you think about something that's everywhere and nowhere and keeps you from sort of thinking about what it takes to run the thing.
And Dennis, in this context, what data are we talking about? What form does it take?
Boy, data is just about everything. Emails, photos, spreadsheets, tweets. Just look back a little bit into history. Our own use of data. Back in the 90s, you'd send out an email, which is just a text message, and it was a few kilobytes of data. Then in the 2000s, we sent attachments like photos and PowerPoint slides, and it was a few megabytes worth of data. And now in the 2010s, we're streaming two-hour HD movies from Netflix, and that's a few gigabytes of data. So, I mean, that's an increase of 1,000 every decade. So that's an awful lot of data.
And, James, you wrote in your series that we think of data as being clean. Most of us don't think of data as something that uses or requires energy when transmitted or stored. How much energy is required to stream a movie, for example, or this radio show?
It's hard to break it out in sort of retail form, you might say, and I think that there's a lot of work to be done to explain to people that these habits we've all developed do take energy individually and collectively. I look mostly at the collective side of things, and I think the most telling statistic I came across was that it's become pretty much like every other major industry out there. It's using about 2% of all electricity in the United States now, which is very similar to the pulp and paper industry. It's very similar to the transportation manufacturing industry, and it's very similar to some of the other industries we know and love, but also remain wary of in the sense that we want to keep track of how that energy is being used and how much we're using when we do one of these transactions or buy a product, something like that.
Well, how do we even know that it's 2% or 5%? Is it really possible to estimate how much power is required for data storage?
The way we did that, we do know how to do that. It was first carried out as a sort of a calculation by EPA back in the mid-2000s, and there's a researcher at Stanford University, Jonathan Kumi, who actually tracked all sales of servers in the world and in the United States over a certain period, and then just calculated up how long those servers would be in use and how much electricity they would be using, and that way you can actually estimate this number. It's amazing.
But I thought, Dennis, that one of the reasons cloud computing has taken off is because the costs of data storage have gone down a lot.
Well, the cost of data storage, you know, per bit has gone down, but the amount of data that is being stored is going way up. It's, you know, it's amazing how fast it's growing compared to everything else.
And where is it being stored?
Oh, boy. It's being stored in data centers, you know, around the world, you know, and it's being stored. And in order to store it, you need disk drives to store the data. You need servers to pick the data off of the storage disks. Then you need internet switches to send that data out to whoever's requesting it.
So is it fair to call a data storage facility an internet factory? I mean, we don't think of the internet as something industrial, but should we?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the internet, you know, pulls data back and forth across the country, and, you know, It sells books. It tweets things. You can play games in it. You do your business on it.
James, where are the data storage facilities most often located? Are they in the outskirts of town, way out in the country, where we can't see them?
Well, they're sort of hidden in plain sight, is what I found in the reporting. There are vast concentrations of these things people don't see off highways in Northern Virginia, where electricity prices are low, in huge warehouse-like buildings out there. They're tucked away in stories of high-rises where you can't see in the windows, and you figure it's a business office of some kind. No, there'll be a bunch of servers inside. They're just dotted around the country with just an increasing frequency and scale, but they don't usually have names on the outside. They don't identify themselves. If it's a Microsoft facility, for example, one I reported out in rural Washington doesn't say Microsoft on the outside. So you're sort of left to wonder, but if you see a building that is warehouse-like, no name on it, and has what appears to be little smokestacks from generators dotting the roof or around it, that's often a data center.
My guests are James Glantz of the New York Times and Dennis Szymanski, the Senior Project Manager at the Electric Power Research Institute in Palo Alto. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. James, that place in Washington, in Quincy, Washington, you say initially it was greeted by all of its neighbors, and then they started getting upset because it was causing a lot of pollution?
It's a number of things. I mean, I think the story there is very much, it's a sort of a Microsoft comes to town kind of story, and there was a lot of excitement. And I still think among especially political leaders, they retain support there. But they were out there welcome with some people, much in the way that a big industrial concern often does in a place like that. Creates a few jobs. In the case of data centers, it is a very few jobs. But tax base goes up a little bit, and then people like that. But at the same time, big companies tend to throw their weight around. They did in Quincy. We reported that.
Well, Microsoft got into a real fight with the utility company, didn't it?
They did. That was sort of the culmination of some of this last year when Microsoft missed the projection in terms of how much electricity it was going to use by the code of the local utility. That meant it was supposed to pay a penalty. But in order to basically dodge the penalty, they began burning power to no use, to no purpose, so that they could meet a projection. And that was not obviously consistent with their corporate responsibility statements, the kinds of rules of the road they say they operate by in Quincy. And so it was a big controversy at the time.
Dennis, are we seeing similar controversies in other parts of the country?
Not so much. I think the utilities in many cases like the technology of these big data centers coming into their territory, and they're for the most part they're well behaved, very predictable customers. So in most cases the utilities are greeting them with open arms.
James, was that your experience? How did you come to write this series? Was there something that caught your attention as a journalist?
I had no idea that this industry used these amounts of electricity. I was doing an odd story on a geothermal energy company that happened to have been invested in by Google. And Google turns out to be, in relative terms, it uses a tremendous amount of energy, but more responsible in the types of technology it uses than many companies. But I was in a room with Google officials, and I said, why did you invest in this renewable energy source? And they said, well, we use a lot of energy, and we want some more clean resources. And I said, well, you use a lot of energy. How much energy do you use? And at the time, they had not disclosed how much energy they used, and they all looked at me, and for some reason I thought of a picture of Leonid Brezhnev I saw once, people looking at me just sort of stony-faced all of a sudden with their Google T-shirts, and I realized I must have stumbled across something interesting here. Here's a part of the economy I thought was sort of all for free, as most people do, and it turns out they use tremendous amounts of energy, and so I started looking into it.
Now, is part of the inefficiency just the way it has been put together helter-skelter? I've always wondered, when I write an email message to somebody in my office or down the block, Does it go directly to them, or does it wind up going to Anchorage, Alaska, and then to Quincy, Washington, and then to some place in Virginia before it gets to them?
Yeah, Dennis has actually looked at this, I believe. He probably has a good answer for that.
Yeah, I mean, the Internet has multiple paths. In case one of them is down for some reason, your email, you know, the first time you send it could go through Dallas and then directly to Washington. The next time it goes through Chicago and New York City and then down to Washington. So it's like it's a redundant system. So there's a lot of features of this that make it so reliable and so effective. And yet there's a lot of pieces to it, and they've all got they all need power.
But why is it so inefficient? Couldn't we just have something that had my message, unless I was sending it to Washington, just go to some local, what we call it, a facility, and then get moved over to the person down the block? Is that happening ever?
It's just way more complicated than that. I mean, I think one day we checked it out and looked at just one message, and it had, you know, it can go, if you're sending a photo to somebody next door, let's say, and you're using, you know, Gmail or Yahoo or something like that, you have to realize that you first are accessing the server on which all this is sitting, which could be out, say, in Palo Alto out there or somewhere else in Silicon Valley, or it could be in Canada. And then it's going to process your request. You know, you've gone, you know, 1,000 miles or whatever it is to get there. It finds what you want, and then it sends it back along another line, might not be the same set of lines, to your neighbor across country, another 500,000 miles, whatever it is, and finally it arrives across the street. And all this is happening invisibly, and we just haven't thought about that. We don't think about it. So it seems simple, but in fact, the way it works is incredibly circuitously.
And then, as you point out in your article, it can have negative effects on the neighbors of these facilities. In Santa Clara, California, which is a hub of technology facilities in Silicon Valley, diesel emissions from generators at a Microsoft data center caught the attention of regulators for potentially threatening the health of workers at nearby businesses.
That's an amazing factor, this whole thing. I mean, you've got to have, the way that they've set the system up is that it's got to be available 24/7, you know, basically forever. And so if there's even a slight outage on a power line or let alone a blackout, you've got banks of often thousands of batteries. They're sort of lead-acid batteries akin to car and truck batteries. And then you've got this second set of backups, which are huge diesel generators. And for some reason, certain companies use them more than others. They're said to be just for backup in absolute emergencies, but they're just not always used that way. And the companies, I actually found records to show how often they were using them. And it just turns out, for whatever reason, Microsoft, in the two places I looked, used the engines for cumulative usage. If you look at all the engines, of thousands of hours a year. And so in California, they were caught in something called the Hot Spots program, which is a program to try to reduce particular point sources of pollution because they potentially were threatening the health of nearby workers. And then there was a not in my backyard fight with neighbors in Quincy because of their generator usage there.
Well, you are say in the article that most data centers by design consume vast amounts of energy in a wasteful manner. Why would anybody do that by design?
Well, it's part of what one of my sources called the original sin of the field. Most of the energy used in data centers is really taken up by idle computing. And it's computing because they're so focused on always keeping the data center running. It means that they have to be ready for any unexpected surge in traffic, whether real or imaginary. And so they tend to keep, let's say, from 6 to 12% were the figures we got from a consulting firm that looked at some of this from the inside on a lot of companies. 6 to 12% of the electricity that actually reaches the servers ever is used for any useful computing. The rest of it
is just basically servers sitting there waiting for something to do, and they usually don't have anything to do. So when you look at electricity loss and other things like cooling and other mechanical things in the data center, which also has to happen because you generate all this heat because all the electricity is flowing through there, you can actually waste 30 times as much energy in these data centers, let's say a typical data center, as you do use in actual computing, useful computing. So that's amazing. Seems counterintuitive, but because of the inherent kind of risk aversion and conservatism in how they run these data centers, that's the way they operate. Again, let's say a typical data center, not a super advanced one or a highly, you know, up-to-the-minute kind of environmentally sensitive one.
Well, Dennis, is this true all over the world, or is the United States a particularly egregious case?
Well, you know, what's happening is all these new data centers are becoming more and more efficient with the cooling load. You know, there used to be, you know, an equal amount of power going into the cooling as there was going into the computer itself. And now, you know, that number has been vastly reduced with these new data centers. And Apple and Google and others have done a really good job on these brand new facilities. You know, they've got great cooling technologies, but the electrical load is very high, you know, and a lot of the old data centers, which are basically, you know, like maybe 99% of the data centers in the U.S., are located in places like hospitals and city halls and universities, you know, banks and everything else, and they have less efficient cooling technologies because most of those are older data centers. So they've got a ways to go with both the electrical and the mechanical, you know, cooling load.
Well, James Ceres points out that worldwide, the digital warehouses use about 30 billion watts of electricity, which is roughly equivalent to the output of 30 nuclear power plants. This is just for digital warehouses. And the United States has about one-third of that load?
Yeah, a third to a quarter, we estimate. And it's a lot of electricity, and it's hard to say where that's going. It's sort of they've found themselves sort of growing so fast, as Dennis pointed out, so fast over the last couple of decades, that you're talking about a shift from a couple of servers or a couple of desktop computers in a back room of a warehouse or a dorm room or something, to now these industrial-sized loads that use as much as a small town or a medium-sized town in some cases. And they've been slow to streamline the technology beyond just sort of expanding the way they did it before. And now that they've reached the size and scale of a lot of the other industries that they both compete and cooperate with, the question is, will they find ways to change how they consume that energy, or will it just continue to grow at the rate we've seen? And I think that the question of that is unknown, or the answer to that is unknown at this point.
My guests are James Glanz, whose series on power pollution and the Internet has run in the New York Times. And James, we really appreciate your coming on our show at this very sad time. You're in your hometown?
I am. Thanks for mentioning. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I'm out in Dubuque, Iowa. It's my hometown. I'm out here for a memorial to my father, Irv Glanz, who was a well-known and much beloved sportscaster, covered the Green Bay Packers in their heyday, and had his start here, right here in town.
Also with us is Dennis Szymanski, Senior Project Manager at the Electric Power Research Institute in its Palo Alto office. And our number here is 212-433-9692 if you want to join the conversation. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We will be right back after this. And we are back with our look at the clouds, the Internet, data storage and related matters with Dennis Szymanski, Senior Project Manager at the Electric Power Research Institute in Palo Alto, and James Glanz of the New York Times, who wrote a series on power pollution and the Internet for his newspaper that ran last, I guess it was Friday and Saturday?
Sunday and Monday.
Ah, well, I knew it was a couple days recently. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's go to one of those calls. Keith from New York City. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking. I was very impressed with Mr. Glantz's articles, and but I was just wondering, the idea came up, who's paying for the, the expense of building the servers and maintaining them? I look at Google, I don't see any advertising there. Is it coming from where?
Well, it's a cost of doing business. It's a really good question, because when you look at the money that goes into the servers, it's really impressive. I mean, I looked at one case where they had to report it for tax purposes, and one big data center can have $150, $200 million in servers in place at one time. And these things basically roll over every 3 years or so, 3 to 5 years. So they're replacing those at a really fast rate. And it's part of the business model. Where exactly that's going to start to bite eventually, it's hard to say, but it kind of reminds me of just before sort of Japanese imports started to come into the auto industry in the United States. You can be inefficient in costs until somebody else figures out how to do it better, and I think that's where the pinch will eventually come.
Thank you for your call. A listener has written in wondering about whether there's a trade-off, because he says there's energy that's saved by using the Internet. Buying online saves trips to the store, et cetera.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and if you want to do some research, you used to have to drive in your car to go to the library to look up in the encyclopedia. You know, and now you can go upstairs on your iPad and Google, search, whatever it is that you're interested in, and get an instantaneous answer without using much energy. And as a matter of fact, EPRI did some studying, and it cost less than $1.50 per year to run your iPad.
EPRI is your organization, Electric Power Research Institute.
Yes.
A listener asks how many people are employed at these data barns, and are they giant buildings with rows of servers in them?
Well, that's right. And it's hard to compare it to traditional industries, because this doesn't work the same way as a traditional industry. But you'll have a lot of people who are employed during construction, just as you do with any building. And then afterward, you'll get, for even a huge data center, maybe 50 jobs. I'd be surprised if it's 100. Many of those are not people who are there all the time. They might be circling around at different data centers around the country owned by that company. So it's not a big job creation mechanism, at least locally, and that's one of the criticisms they've received in places where they use tremendous amounts of power, because they'll say, how many jobs per megawatt are these producing? Very different from a place that might be manufacturing, hand trucks or axles for cars or something like that.
In some cases, buildings that were used for other purposes have been converted, like the Western Union building in downtown New York.
Well, I guess one I should mention, our former printing plant in Edison, New Jersey, is now a gigantic data center owned by another company.
The New York Times.
Yeah, that's right.
Tony from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, everybody. Yeah, I've been in the data center business for longer than I'd like to imagine, and I actually disagree with some of the statements that were made, because your speakers are making it sound as though the data center industry is irresponsible and using power irresponsibly, I believe. Many of us in the business have been expending a lot of time and effort to actually reduce the amount of power per transaction or per piece of data that's stored, and been very successful in reducing our power usage rather than increasing it. So I wondered what you'd have to say about that.
A coming Natural Resources Defense Council report will reveal that not all clouds are created equal. There are green clouds and brown clouds. Some more energy efficient than others.
Yeah, I'm glad he called in and mentioned that, because there are a lot of good players in this field. There are a lot of advances that have been made, but as Dennis said earlier, one thing to keep in mind is it's really the amount of data versus how much it costs to keep it, and the amount is increasing so fast that even the best players are having a hard time keeping up with that. That's one answer to the question. The other one is that you find some of the best workers in this field, best researchers, engineers, and they'll say, oh, gosh, look how hard I've worked to decrease my energy usage. that's true, but in a way that has happened on the margins of the field, the enterprise, we call the enterprise, the Fortune 500 scale and all, data centers, and also all the tiny ones that Dennis mentioned, all scattered through hospitals and banks and so forth, they haven't all gotten the word, and they account for most of the energy usage and most of the waste. So it's tough for somebody like the caller, who I'm sure has done a great job with this and absolutely is accurate in saying that many people are trying to reduce that energy usage, make it more efficient. It's just that the bulk of the energy usage in the field is being operated by people who aren't quite getting that message yet or aren't able to put it into practice.
I agree to that point that many aren't, but I work for a Fortune 500, and we've been very successful in both reducing our power usage and stemming the growth of data, which is a major issue.
Thank you for calling
us,
Terry.
Thanks.
Another listener, Sean in Brooklyn, left this question on our show page. Will data centers become more efficient when solid-state drives become more common in them because there are fewer moving parts?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of new technologies that are coming up. Solid-state drives, there are things like CPUs that have multi-cores that will shut down individual cores when they're not needed to reduce the amount of energy that's needed. And there's a lot of other technologies, virtualization, to have multiple server applications running on a single server. There's things like higher efficiency power supplies that can be used. You can even run data center equipment on 380-volt DC instead of the regular AC power to save energy. There's many things that are being researched right now and demoed to try to help all of the data centers, small, medium, and large, to become more energy efficient.
One of our listeners, Stephen, from the Upper East Side, asks about the opportunities for capturing some of the excess heat generated by data centers for other purposes. He says he's heard about interesting ways of doing this, such as brewing beer even. Is there such an excess that it can't all be put to some other less wasteful use?
Yeah, there are some data centers. Syracuse University has recaptured a lot of the heat from their data center to heat the office building during the winter. So I mean, there's a lot of things that you can do. It takes a little bit of ingenuity and a little bit extra money, but overall, it makes for a better, cleaner data center.
Another listener asked, why are companies like Amazon and Apple encouraging customers to use their clouds? Do they make money on them, or the rights and terms of use more favorable to the consumer or to the company?
Well, that's a complicated question. If they're advertising to consumers to use the cloud, then certainly they have a business model that leads to some sort of profits. I didn't study that specifically, it's really interesting to look at the growth and the scale of that cloud. I think that Dennis has looked a little bit at North Carolina and the expansion of the scale of the cloud services and the data centers being built down there. Is that right, Dennis?
Yeah. I mean, that's where Apple has their iCloud data center. And, it's a brand-new dedicated facility that they've also integrated with a fuel cell energy store, energy generation, and a huge array of photovoltaic panels to try to cut down the amount of electricity that they have to buy. So they're generating some of it themselves.
Mike from Morristown, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. That's some of the things you just said is a nice segue into what I guess I wanted to comment on. Up until this past June, I was working for the biggest technology company in the country, and I was involved for a half a decade doing nothing but trying to figure out how to squeeze more computing power into a certain amount of power budget for some of our big clients in New York City. We'd be building these data centers or helping them to build these data centers out in Virginia, and there was a budget. There were about 3.5 megawatts for each room that they put in, and when they started, they could put 10,000 servers in a room. By the time I left, they were putting 12 or 14,000 servers in there. So the efficiency is increasing, and there's a chance of it increasing vastly in the near future. Right now, it's a monoculture. Take a look at every computer that's out there, virtually every computer that's out there, except for small niche players. They're all running with the same chips. And that means that everybody is the same. I can tell you that the typical server chip is going to be using between 95 watts at a typical one, or if you want to spend extra money for special low-power ones, you can get it down to 60 watts or so, maybe a little bit lower than that. But if you go to any computer manufacturer, that's about as good as you're going to get. It's not a lot of changes there. RAM adds some use. People talked about solid-state storage. Each disk takes about 13 watts. Your solid-state device takes like 1 watt. So you're saving a lot there, but look at the difference. The disks are running at, you know, 13 watts, and the CPUs are running at 90 watts. There's a big, you know, we know where all the power is going, and it's into the CPUs. Now, what a lot of manufacturers are looking at right now is to change that monoculture. There are a large number of CPUs out there that use like 1/100th to 1/200th of the power, and they're sitting in your cell phone. So there's a lot of looking at changing from what we in the industry refer to the x86 architecture to the architecture of what's being used in cell phones, which is ARM architecture. And we're talking about, instead of something that...
Mike, we have 10 seconds.
Okay, well.
Okay, well.
Yeah, that was, I can respond to that. That was maybe a little bit of advertising for ARM, which is, as I recall, is a British firm.
And we have to leave it there. I'm sorry. Okay. We really only had 10 seconds.
Right.
Thank you both so much, James Glanz and Dennis Szymanski. It's been a fascinating Please Explain.